This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, Sharifa Aini with Swasana Hari Raya. It is 6:09, and you're with Lynn and Kelvin. We are about a day away from Raya, which, as we know, is a season of family, forgiveness and celebration, all things that we have covered on the show and on the station before. So we thought we would change the focus a little bit. There are other material hallmarks of this time of year, and for the next 2 days, we're going to be focusing on some of the key elements that shape the season. So we're talking about things like the culture, the traditions, the food, the clothes, the shopping. So kicking off with today, the familiar sounds of your friendly neighbourhood Baram.
For many of us, joining the throngs of people at the Ramadan bazaars is almost like an annual Malaysian pilgrimage to take in the sights and smells of the plethora of dishes on offer. But the popularity of the param is said to be in decline. We sent our intern, Ezrin, off to our neighbourhood param to find out who's been going and how often they are making these excursions.
For this year, kurang. Dia dalam 5 kali.
So far, I only go once a week on the weekend because I'm working during the week, so it's a bit hard to come. So we make sure me and my sister come either Saturday or Sunday.
Not often, no, because from my culture, like the Arab culture, we prefer to cook at home. But like when I'm too tired or lazy, then I'd love to come here. Yeah. But maybe once a week, I would say, in Ramadan, like 4 times I've come here. Yeah.
Not that often because I'm a working staff. By the time I reach the Bazaar Ramadan, most of the food has been sold. So I don't get anything except weekends, like today. It's heavy, pouring, but my kids insist that they should come, so we came.
So anybody who's been to a param will know this. There's a whole bunch of things to tempt you. Here's a sampling of what this year's param goers are going for.
Selalu beli nasi kukus sedek dengan air mangga.
I go for roti john. I like to go for samosas as well. Right now at the TTDI market, they have yummy burgers, so I'm going for that as well. And then we try to avoid rice in Ramadan, so we go for a bit more carbs in terms of bread.
Variety from what bubur is this? Bubur kacang hijau to apam balik. Sometimes it's just some ayam percik.
So I'm vegetarian and I find it very difficult to find things. So it's just noodles or rice, and I always ask them not to put the chicken with it. And then like the papaya and the dessert. Oh my God, yeah, for sure, 100%, all the types. Because I'm just vegetarian, I'm not vegan, so I can still have all the types of desserts that they have here.
This year, there's been a lot more conversation around params and food wastage. We wanted to know if people were still buying more than they intended to at the param.
Maybe slightly, but we know how to like ration our portions, actually. So we're not so bad.
At times. We are more cautious nowadays. We are quite used to Bazaar Ramadan, so we are more cautious because we end up going home and saying like, wow, we have bought too much and we can't finish everything. So it's a waste. So we buy, we choose, we walk through the bazaar and then we decide what we actually want instead of buying everything that we see or tempt us. So we choose and then we decide. There are times where it still gets a bit too full, but we still eat like because it's bazaar once a year.
No, because I always have that non-materialistic, like even now I knew that I wanted so many more things, but I always knew that it would go to waste and I'm not okay with that. But before, like I think a couple of years back when I wasn't so aware of like the issues, of course I would definitely overbuy. But now it's good.
So we're going to be finding out a little later how Pasar Ramadans actually came to be. But as to why the crowds keep coming in droves, the answer seems pretty clear.
Maybe sebab makanan yang tak pernah jumpa dan dekat bazar boleh jumpa.
I think more choices. So you have all kinds of choices from sweet to savory. You have like little snacks, you have proper meals. So when you have so much variety, it's great, but it's also hard for a person who's fasting. You just want to buy more and more.
Gosh, if there's a lot of people, I think this is really weird because that's uncontrollable. But I think if there's really good food, then there's going to be a lot of people.
The variety of food, the different type of food. Sometimes you come here, something new is happening. They create new recipes. So that's the exciting part. It's like, wow, there's something new. We need to try that kind of thing. So we try it.
That is a slice of the Pasar Ramadan experience this year. After this, as promised, we're going to be speaking with a professor about the origins of the Param, as well as how Raya celebrations overall have evolved over the years. Keep it here on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bringing fresh meaning. BFM 89.9.
You're listening to the Evening Edition with Lynn and Kelvin. It is the first of our two Raya specials today, where we look at perhaps some of the more material hallmarks of the fasting month and the ensuing celebrations, like shopping, Raya cards, advertising, and params, which we just heard about. So we were curious to find out how modernization has shaped Raya celebrations as we see them today. What did people do before params existed? What was Raya like before heartfelt Raya ads on TV were something to look forward to?
To answer some of those questions, we have on the line distinguished Professor Dr. Shamsul Amri Baharuddin, Director of the Institute of Ethnic Studies at UKM. Prof, thank you for joining us on the show today. To start us off, can you walk us through a typical first day of celebrating present-day Raya?
I would say it's very difficult to establish a typical Hari Raya day, but I can establish a pattern that people follow. Basically, the first thing people do is the first time you can eat in the morning. So a lot of people wake up, have their food and whatnot, and then they will go, the second activity, they go to the mosque. When they arrive at the mosque, many people who still wouldn't pay the zakat or fitrah, that's the time they will pay the zakat and fitrah before the prayer starts. Because when the prayer starts, it's the end. You cannot pay anymore. You have to pay before. And then you have two choices. You either go back and eat again, a bigger meal, or you visit cemetery to remind yourself of those who have passed away, and you read various verses and dua, and with the children, and you can see there suddenly there are a lot of children moving around, joining us for the prayers and getting their monetary reward for sitting down with us and listening and dua at the same time, yeah? So we don't change very much in this pattern of what we do, because after that we have lunch again. You don't have a second meal, you have lunch, and then you start visiting or receiving visitors.
Right, and have you seen a change in the way that we celebrate Raya over time, and what are the things that have driven those shifts?
Yes, I think the most important part is we haven't changed that pattern. What we have changed is the content. For example, when we were basically an agricultural society, that became the basis of setting up how Hari Raya is and what are the events and the values that have been inputted in that process. That's why the role of peasant society is the origin of a lot of this Hari Raya. And you can see the notion of rumah terbuka, open house, because the houses during the period of the agricultural period is really open house, in a sense that there's no fence, it's only bushes that separate them. So the notion of open house is literally open house, as opposed to now you get invitation to go to an open house. See, so there's transformation of the idiom there, you know, capturing different activities, but still being used as the idiom to explain the openness, the willingness, the independence one has, and the choice one could make. And then we came to our industrial or secondary economy, where we have industrialization and then husband-wife working. So suddenly, the way Hari Raya is celebrated has changed because there's a lot more money involved. Less of the agricultural product, the rice, the ketupat. A lot of the people will buy. We begin to make, and there's a business, small, medium industry people starting making cakes, keropok, all sorts of kuih. Yeah? And that is when people begin to create Bazaar Ramadan. Bazaar Ramadan, I think, became very popular after the new economic policy and the expansion of Malay middle class. So Bazaar Ramadan, you can find in every town in the whole country. They make money for the whole month. They do business. And they don't do really special things. They're cooking the same cakes. And now you can see this cake is manufactured in a larger volume, you know. And you can order through the internet now. It's quite incredible when I see my relatives, my children and grandchildren transforming Hari Raya according to their industrialization position. And finally, when we have the service economy or service industry, it changes Hari Raya again. For example, we don't see very much Hari Raya card now. They are all sent by internet or sent through WhatsApp. So it's quite interesting how the big macro transformation of the economy from primary to secondary to the tertiary economy transform Hari Raya in terms of content and choice.
Are there any rituals and practices that were commonplace before but have since become obsolete?
I wouldn't say it's obsolete. What it becomes is this. It becomes embedded into the many layers of the behavior and rituals that have been established according to the economy. Because when you have rice growers celebrating Hari Raya, it's different from the cash crop growers. Because just the volume of money is different and the amount of money they can spend. But you can see, you know, new clothes and whatnot. So you can see this pattern is still the same. You can see you go to the market now. You can see thousands of these clothes are being sold. They're already ready-made. But not before. Before, they're all made by tailors. But later, when this manufacturing becomes a way of life, they also manufacture items that relate to Hari Raya. So you can see for yourself. Of course, those middle class, with money and fashion taste, they would like to go to a branded kind of Baju Melayu place. So you can see the class differences suddenly appear in the way Hari Raya is celebrated. So nothing is really obsolete, but things have become transformed and informed by the economy and also the richness that people acquire.
So is it fair then to say that to some degree Raya celebrations are just evolving with the times?
Yeah. So I think what we are looking at is the transformation culturally and behavior from a very family-centered behavior, you know, which remains so until now. But there is also this element of consumerism that creeps in that makes Hari Raya different. Advertising, and then videos. I remember the late movie maker, the late Yasmin, was one of the pioneers of making this short TV advertisement for different companies. And many others joined her to do that. But now, these short videos are shown in our WhatsApp, for example, celebrating some set, some, you know, depending on the theme they want to highlight. So it's quite interesting, the agenda and the story and what they reveal during Hari Raya. So this is the, what I mean by evolving. Because the notion of Hari Raya now with the new social media has become a lot more emotional, appealing to some sense. So there's a high nostalgic value in all this. You see, the songs, all the same songs. The Saloma song is the key to all. And then there are some DJ Dave song. All these are later day artists who sang new version of Hari Raya. And of course, Sudirman's there. So the continuity in that evolving process makes the Hari Raya different, but in some ways, they are still the same.
How has the modernization of Raya celebrations impacted the spirit of the season? Do you see it as a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I wouldn't say good or bad. I would say the modernization add a material value to Hari Raya, more than just shaking hands, saying sorry, a lot more, because there's a lot more material input in the Hari Raya process, whether the dress you buy, sending money everywhere, you know, getting the clothes prepared. So it's quite interesting how modernization in that sense has allowed homogenization of processes of production, even for Hari Raya. So the spirit of Hari Raya remains there, but the way it is being celebrated, the paraphernalia that fulfill what Hari Raya should be, becomes business-like, consumerist-like, marketing and so on and so forth.
And are you seeing any patterns that suggest potential changes in the way that Raya might evolve in the future?
I'm very concerned that our society is moving from diversity to super diversity. Super diversity is a lot more fragmented and complex pluralities. So we have now, we have Burmese, but not only Burmese, there are Shan, there are Rohingyas, there are Karens. So it's same with Indonesia. We now see Indonesia not only Indonesian, but there are Minangkabau, there are Bugis, there are Achenes. A new form of diversity. And this super diversity will allow the demonstration or Hari Raya celebration of different culture around this region being exhibited in Malaysian Hari Raya, for example. How the impact of super diversity transform the nature of the colorfulness of Hari Raya, the variety. So it is important for us to watch the fragmentation, the atomization of Hari Raya according to these little groups. So the external and internal differences will provide the potential changes in the way we celebrate Hari Raya in Malaysia.
Prof. Shamsul, thank you so much for sharing your perspective with us today. That was Distinguished Professor Datuk Dr. Shamsul Amri Baharudin, Director of the Institute of Ethnic Studies at UKM. After this, we are going to talk about the date, and not the date at which we all start public holidays, but the date that we eat to break our fast, basically, which is, of course, one of the most central foods for the Raya season. So stay tuned to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bodacious, fabulous minds. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
It is 6:36. You're listening to the Evening Edition with Lynn and Kelvin. It is day one of our two-day Raya special, headed up, of course, to the first day of Raya. And we've spoken a little bit about params. We've spoken about the evolution of Raya over the years and how it's changing and how it might continue to change in the future. And now we turn our attention to food. So one food item that's become a staple on the buka table during the month of Ramadan is, of course, none other than the date fruit. So for Muslims, it's perhaps the most sacred in the fruit kingdom. Prophet Muhammad himself used to break each fast with a few fresh or dried dates.
So we were curious to know more about where and how dates are produced and why it's so central to the fasting experience. To do that, we are crossing over to Naj Arifin, who is a foodie in every sense of the word. He researches, writes and conducts tours on food.
Naj, thanks very much for joining us. So let's start with this, right? There is a type of date called Ajwa, which was described by Prophet Muhammad as fruit from paradise. How did dates gain this elevated status, and how did it, despite predating Islam, come to be so strongly associated with Muslims and the month of Ramadan?
In a way, it's accidental, simply because dates are native to Arabia, and that's where Islam was born. But then again, the date tree is really, or the date palm is really a gift of God to the desert. In a similar way that the coconut palm is the gift of God to the tropics, because both of them have so many uses that it becomes something that is ingrained as part of the culture, part of the staple diet, part of how people live. Because besides the date itself, which is so nutritious, similar to the coconut palm, has so many uses. The trunk can be used for columns for buildings, and indeed the very first mosque was built using date palm columns. The fronds can be used for thatching to make the roof, and the wood chips can be used to make small fires to cook, especially to make your tea. Even the pit of the date itself has so many uses. It can even be ground into a kind of flour. So, you know, there's so many things. The Prophet himself happened to plant the date from the particular achua tree species or subspecies. And so it became a special tree and it bore fruits which became special fruits because they were planted by the hand of the prophet himself. And so ever since the dates that have sprung from that particular tree that was planted by the prophet has been planted elsewhere as well and has become quite prolific. So with the date being where it was, with the birth of Islam in the same place, naturally it carried a very special significance that became very universal for Muslims everywhere in the world.
Is there any other type of fruit or food that's comparable to the date?
Actually, not really, especially in terms of its overall being packed with really with nutrients. For example, dates are full of both protein and carbohydrates and very good kind of sugars, including glucose and fructose, and also even many kinds of minerals like vitamin C, iron, magnesium, potassium, calcium. There's such a good variety in it that just a few pieces are almost as good as a whole meal of, let's say, you know, rice and lao. If you have nothing else to eat in the desert, it really helps to keep you alive. So that's why it's so special as a fruit, and no other fruit comes quite close to it. The earliest evidence of consumption by humans was in Egypt around 7,000 to 8,000 years ago. It's really a very, very ancient food. Naturally, humans would have discovered it very early on. And it's not just for humans, but it was collected. And the most tasty ones for human tongues were reserved for people, but the less tasty ones were packed into like cake-like things. And they were also fed to the camels on journeys. So even camels also benefited from the same fruit. Other ways that it is eaten is could be made into a syrup. And again, that syrup is a nutritious thing that you bring with you as a kind of a molasses drink. And the thing is, the dates, in any natural form that they are left in, they can last very long because the glucose and fructose that it's made of is the kind that is so compact that it's a bit difficult for, let's say, bacteria to damage it. So it lasts for a very long time. And everybody knows that once it's dried out, it can last almost forever.
So can you tell us about the significance of having a date to break one's fast? Why is it considered the best way to start the meal?
Okay. Now, that is part of the sunnah or the tradition of the prophet, where to break the fast, you eat dates in at least one or three, five, and so on in odd numbers. And actually, scientifically, there's also good evidence that dates are, in fact, the best things for you to break your fast with because, as mentioned earlier, they contain so many nutrients which your body needs after you've been fasting for a day. And because it's a natural fruit, and we all know that the more natural it is, the easier our intestines absorb the nutrients. So you eat it raw, you eat it fresh, and as it comes down into your intestines, it breaks down very easily into the bloodstream. So it's really a very perfect kind of fruit to break the fast with, simply because it has all those nutrients that your body needs in order to refresh itself.
So dates seem to come in varying shapes and sizes. Some are a little juicier and sweeter than others. What are the varieties of dates that are out there? How much can the cost and quality of it vary?
There are roughly around 12 to 19 different subspecies of date palms. But even from there, they break down into so many different varieties of the dates themselves. Because even one subspecies of date palm, when it's grown in different places, it produces different kind of fruit. And there is a claim that there are about even up to 3,000 varieties of actual dates. Although I kind of think that's a bit exaggerated, but there's that claim. Commercially around the world, there are about 20 varieties that are most popular, although, of course, there are much, much more than 20. And obviously, Ajwa dates, that's one of them. And indeed, that's one of the most expensive. In Malaysia, they retail for about 120 to 170 ringgit per kilogram. So that's very expensive compared to the average ones, which retail for about 50 to 80 kilograms, and there are even cheaper ones which are less tasty. In Malaysia, we commercially, there are about 12 varieties that are easily available, including ajwa. But in the Middle East, if you go to a typical souk or a typical market anywhere in the Middle East, you'll find at least about 50 odd in any one kind of date shop, ranging from the colors, which range from very bright red, bright yellow, to deep purple, to jet black. You know, so many. And there are some that taste very bland, and there are some that taste so sweet that if you're not used to it, you can't take more than one bite. That's why in Malaysia, we only have a set number of varieties because the Malaysian taste is quite limited. But among the Arabs, among the people of the Middle East, they even know which ones are good for which kinds of uses. You know, there are some that are better for dessert. There are some that are better for a full meal. There are some that go well with cheese. Through thousands of years, they know how to match how each one goes with what kind of cooking or what kind of event even.
So obviously with the season being what it is, it's big business. How big is the date export industry? Does the Middle East have this market cornered?
Okay, the date export industry is quite huge, actually. I don't have the figures, but I do know that they are in the billions of dollars worth of trade in the world market. That I'm very sure of. It is a very big source of livelihood for many of the farmers and plantations in throughout the Middle East. The Middle East is, of course, the biggest producer, but other than the Middle East and North Africa, don't be surprised, there is a healthy export also from the southwestern United States, especially in the California region. So they also have a share, a market share, even though it's not as big as the Middle East. But southwestern United States also has a good production, about 7,500 acres. And again, don't be surprised, China has gone into the market as well. Some arid parts of China, they've already started a plantation and producing for quite a number of years, but still not as big as the Middle East. And in the Middle East, the biggest producing countries are obviously Saudi Arabia, together with Iran, Jordan, Egypt, and the North African Arab countries such as Algeria, Tunisia.
Where do the dates we import to Malaysia come from, and what's the size of the market here?
My personal estimate of the size of the Malaysian market is roughly about up to 20 million ringgit per year. That means about 20 million ringgit worth of all kinds of dates and date products are brought into Malaysia per year. That's about logically about what the Malaysian market can take. And part of the reason why we only have about 12 varieties available commercially in Malaysia is simply because over time, the importers have found that these are the varieties that Malaysians like, as simple as that. So I'm sure they've brought in many other varieties every once in a while, but they found that it didn't sell that well because for Malaysians, it didn't taste how they expect it to be.
So this might seem like a silly question, given our different weather and soil conditions, but could we here in Malaysia ever be producers of date palm trees?
Don't be surprised. Actually, we have successfully planted date palms. It's just that they don't fruit as much as in the Middle East. But actually, in almost every state in Malaysia, you will be surprised that there has been successful date palms grown, even as far south as Johor. The most successful one apparently is in Kelantan, in which there's a plantation of about 50 trees, which do sell their dates. And personally, I haven't tasted them yet. They only sell them locally. They don't sell them nationally. So you have to go to each place. And some of them, they're very privately planted, so they don't even sell. You just have to know the owners and, you know, request for something to taste. But the short answer is that they can grow, especially now with modern technology. It's just that for the moment, they're more as a wow factor kind of thing. But they're not so commercially useful to grow simply because so many are grown in the Middle East and they're so easily imported cheaply. So it's probably not commercially worthwhile to compete with that, as simple as that.
Almost the entire export business of dates is built around the month of Ramadan. How do source countries prepare for this annual surge in demand?
they have been doing this for centuries. So they are experts at planning how much that they, how soon they need to make sure to fertilize them, to make sure that enough amounts come out of the trees. And actually, it's quite a tricky thing because Ramadan changes every year. Yeah, it's not like the four seasons fixed all year round. So I was quite surprised when I started learning about how they did it. It's almost laboratory-like in its precision, in which all these plantation owners and workers, they know how to make sure that the fruiting season for each of their batch of trees. It's a perennial plant, though, so it doesn't come just in season. Although some of the subspecies do have certain seasons that they flower and then they fruit very well compared to other seasons. But it's so precise how they have learned to monitor and to make sure that the production is available for each Ramadan. So it's really, really quite fantastic.
Naj, thank you for taking our call. That was food researcher and historian Naj Arifin speaking to us about the special status that the date has during Ramadan. Next up, we take a look at yet another Raya delicacy, namely lemang. Keep it here on The Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Best flipping moments. BFM 89.9, the business station.
You are listening to The Evening Edition with Lynn and Kelvin, and it is the first part of our two-day Raya special today. We have been looking at a variety of things that, and factors, I suppose, that inform our experience, our lived experience of Raya. So earlier, we talked about barams, we talked about how traditions have changed. We also got a deep dive into the date fruit, courtesy of Naj Arifin. And now, we're going to be taking a look at yet another delicacy that has become really suddenly quite ubiquitous during the Raya festivities, and that is lemang.
And this year, lemang is in the news specifically, a certain kind of lemang called lemang periuk kera, or pitcher plant lemang. Eco-conscious consumers are calling for everyone to avoid this exotic variety of it because the pitcher plant is endangered in our forests.
I'd literally not heard of this. I'd literally not heard of the pitcher plant garang. The pitcher plant lemang. And now I'm just quite simultaneously intrigued and also just, no. You know, if I don't see the value in it. Perhaps if someone's had it and it's just so uber delicious, but even then it's not worth endangering our plants.
It's kind of like a shark fin situation where some people say that it really doesn't add any flavour to it. Some who have tried this version of the lemang have said that it is creamier and milkier in taste.
Nevertheless, we will just have to achieve that in some other way, mm-hmm. I think. Regardless, that's not really the focus of our story at the moment. We are going to take a look, though, at conventional lemang and how the demand just shoots up every time Raya approaches for a specific material, and that is bamboo.
So we wanted to look into the Raya bamboo trade. We visited Kampung Orang Asli Kemensa and we spoke with three villagers who are collecting bamboo for the festive season.
Buluh sesuai. Contohnya buluh sesuai ni macam ni ha. Ni tengok ni, ni ruah dia panjang.
So that's Kasmi talking about finding suitable kinds of bamboo for lemang.
Untuk lemang ni banyak, banyak buluh nama dia. Nama dia buluh akar, buluh padi, buluh alang. Buluh akar petai pun ada. Buluh minyak. Kalau buluh kunyit tu tak boleh sebab dia besar-besar, kuning-kuning.
And here's Susie explaining why the right size of the bamboo is especially important.
Kecil sangat tak boleh. Besar sangat pun tak boleh. Sedang-sedang. Yang kecil susah kan nak masuk daun. Itulah nak masuk daun bayar dia kumpulin.
There are also demands for different lengths of bamboo, from 18 inches to 22. We also found out that it's really just not an easy task to collect bamboo. Here's Kasmi again talking about the difficulties and risks that are involved.
Cari buluh lemang ni bukan senang, susah. Kadang-kadang kita melalui hutan, hujan, bukit-bukit. Kadang-kadang ular pun ada, buluh ni tajam, tak tentu. Ada yang kena tangan kena parang, ada jatuh kena tunggul kaki, pacat lagi, semua melalui susah.
And here's Abu joining Kasmi to talk about how it's been more difficult to find bamboo recently due to the development in the area or competition from other folks outside the village who are now entering the forest to find bamboo as well.
Ini tahun banyak kurang buluh, buluh banyak mati, separuh aja boleh ambil.
Susah, lagi hutan simpan pun dia orang buat perumahan, buat kebun, orang luar buat kebun. Jadi tempat kita orang nak cari makan tu tak ada. Nak cari buluh ni susah.
Collecting and selling bamboo is something that the villagers at Kampung Orang Asli do only when Kampung Orang Asli commence, pardon me, only when the raya season is around the corner. Outside of the festive season, the villagers sell other kinds of forest products or work at the nearby ecotourism chalets.
Kalau biasa yang macam tu, kita ada yang kalau musim madu lebah, kita cari madu. Ada musim petai, kita cari petai. Ada pun kita cari kayu garu, rotan, ikan.
Boleh naik motor.
Sekarang kita kat sini kadang-kadang ambil upah. Kalau tak ada kerja lain, ambil upah di sele-sele kan. Ada di Wongso, ambil atap bertam, ambil buluh, macam-macam lah kayu.
On the day we visited the village, the villagers were also preparing for a celebration in the evening to reward themselves after the hard work of harvesting bamboo.
Ini hari nanti kami orang lepas sudah jual buluh, semalam semua jual buluh. Ini hari kami orang bawa
buat makan-makan.
Ini buat makan sana rumah. Kampung.
Samut lah makan-makan. Penat kerja-kerja kan. Kita orang tebang buluh, kita orang share untuk cari makan lah untuk penat cari buluh.
We also visited two lemang stalls. First up, we spoke to Puan Narayati, who makes and sells lemang at a roadside stall in Taman Tun. Now, when it's not the raya season, she actually cooks and sells nasi campur or mixed rice for a living. Here, Puan Narayati, who is of Minang descent, explains the process of preparing lemang, which she had learned from her elders.
Pertamanya berakulut. Berakulut lepas dicuci, dimasukkan apa tu, daun, masuk buluh. Lepas tu, lepas beras dicuci, dikering. Ditos beras tu, dah kering, masuk buluh beras. Lepas tu, pacar lah sentan, bagi garam. Lepas tu, masukkan ke dalam apa santan buluh tadi. Macam segini, 2 senti beras. Lepas tu, penuhkan dengan santan.
And after that, the lemang is cooked by open fire for at least 2.5 hours.
Kalau kita nak sedap, masaknya 2.5 jam. Dia makin lama kita masak api kecil-kecil kan, lagi lama, lagi sedap masaknya.
According to Puan Narayati, there has been an increase in the price of the ingredients, but she's choosing to maintain the price of the lemang that she sells this raya season.
Tahun dulu, pulut susu 220. Tahun ni 235, naik RM15.
Puan Badria, who operates the Pak Ali Lemang Asli store in Ulu Kelang, agrees that prices of goods have risen, but she has chosen to keep the price of her lemang as well.
Daun pisang pun naik harga. Daun ni lagi teruk naik harga. Daun palas. Ketupat palas. Lagi mahal harga dia.
So unlike Puan Narayati, Puan Badria actually sells lemang all year round. But sales of the lemang at her stall rise sharply during the festive season.
Kalau raya perayaan lebihlah sikit. Kalau biasa dia dalam 70-80 macam tu, kita pasal hotel-hotel ambil kan. Kalau hari raya tu meningkatlah sikit. 7-8 ribu macam tu lah.
And here's Puan Noriati again talking about why lemang is so important for raya.
Kalau tradisi orang Melayu kan, kalau tak ada lemang rasanya kan tak lengkap rasanya. Kalau tak ada lemang, tak meriah rasanya raya. Lemang-lemang tu.
And there you have it, our short exploration of lemang, one of the key delicacies of raya celebrations here in Malaysia. If you missed our previous conversation on Pasar Ramadans, the date industry, how modernization has shaped raya, you can download the show on our podcast. You can check that out, bfm.my or on our app. Tomorrow on the show, we'll be talking about baju raya, the whole process of buying it, designing it, its history. So keep an ear out for that. In the meantime, we are headed to the 7 o'clock news. Keep it here on the evening edition. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my. BFM 89.9, the business station.